Disc 3.
I found Megan, I said. She's coming. Oh, now that is a good thing, exclaimed Elsie Holland. It will take her out of herself. She's rather a nervy girl, you know. Difficult. It will be a great relief to feel I haven't got her on my mind as well as everything else. It's very kind of you, Miss Burton. I hope she won't be a nuisance. Oh, dear, there's the telephone. I must go and answer it. Mr. Symington isn't fit. She hurried out of the room. Joanna said, Quite the ministering angel. You said that rather nastily, I observed. She's a nice, kind girl, and obviously most capable. Most, and she knows it. This is unworthy of you, Joanna, I said. Meaning, why shouldn't the girl do her stuff? Exactly. I never can stand seeing people pleased with themselves, said Joanna. It arouses all my worst instincts. How did you find Megan? Crouching in a darkened room, looking rather like a stricken gazelle. Poor kid. She was quite willing to come. She leapt at it. A series of thuds out in the hall announced the descent of Megan and her suitcase. I went out and took it from her. Joanna, behind me, said urgently, Come on. I've already refused some nice hot tea twice. We went out to the car. It annoyed me that Joanna had to sling the suitcase in. I could get along with one stick now, but I couldn't do any athletic feats. Get in, I said to Megan. She got in. I followed her. Joanna started the car and we drove off. We got to Little Furze and went into the drawing room. Megan dropped into a chair and burst into tears. She cried with the hearty fervour of a child. Bawled, I think is the right word. I left the room in search of a remedy. Joanna stood by, feeling rather helpless, I think. Presently I heard Megan say in a thick, choked voice, I'm sorry for doing this. It seems idiotic. Joanna said kindly, Not at all. Have another handkerchief. I gather she supplied the necessary article. I re-entered the room and handed Megan a brimming glass.
What is it?
A cocktail, I said.
Is it? Is it really?
Megan's tears were instantly dried.
I've never drunk a cocktail.
Everything has to have a beginning, I said. Megan sipped her drink gingerly. Then a beaming smile spread over her face. She tilted her head back and gulped it down at a draught.
It's lovely, she said. Can I have another?
No, I said.
Why not?
In about 10 minutes you'll probably know.
Oh.
Megan transferred her attention to Joanna.
I really am awfully sorry for having made such a nuisance of myself, howling away like that. Can't think why. Seems awfully silly when I'm so glad to be here.
That's all right, said Joanna.
We're very pleased to have you. You can't be really. It's just kindness on your part. But I am grateful.
Please don't be grateful, said Joanna. It will embarrass me.
I was speaking the truth when I said we should be glad to have you.
Jerry and I have used up all our conversation. We can't think of any more things to say to each other.
But now, I said, we shall be able to have all sorts of interesting discussions about Goneril and Regan and things like that.
Megan's face lit up.
I've been thinking about that, and I think I know the answer. It was because that awful old father of theirs always insisted on such a lot of sucking up. When you've always got to be saying thank you and how kind and all the rest of it, it would make you go a bit rotten and queer inside, and you'd just long to be able to be beastly for a change. And when you got the chance, you'd probably find it went to your head and you'd go too far. Old Lear was pretty awful, wasn't he? I mean, he did deserve the snub Cordelia gave him.
I can see, I said, that we're going to have many interesting discussions about Shakespeare.
I can see you two are going to be very highbrow, said Joanna. I'm afraid I always find Shakespeare terribly dreary. All those long scenes where everybody's drunk and it's supposed to be funny.
Talking of drink, I said, turning to Megan, how are you feeling?
Quite all right, thank you.
Not at all giddy? You don't see two of Joanna or anything like that?
No. I just feel as though I'd like to talk rather a lot.
Splendid, I said. Obviously you are one of our natural drinkers. That is to say, if that really was your first cocktail.
Oh, it was.
Good strong head is an asset to any human being, I said. Joanna took Megan upstairs to unpack. Partridge came in, looking sour, and said she had made 2 cup custards for lunch, and what should she do about it?
Chapter 6. The inquest was held 3 days later. It was all done as decorously as possible, but there was a large attendance and, as Joanna observed, the beady bonnets were wagging. The time of Mrs. Symington's death was put at between 3 and 4 o'clock. She was alone in the house. Symington was at his office, the maids were having their day out, Elsie Holland and the children were out walking, and Megan had gone for a bicycle ride. The letter must have come by the afternoon post. Mrs. Symington must have taken it out of the box, read it, and then, in a state of agitation, she had gone to the potting shed, fetched some of the cyanide kept there for taking wasps' nests, dissolved it in water, and drunk it after writing those last agitated words, "I can't go on." Owen Griffith gave medical evidence and stressed the view he had outlined to us of Mrs. Symington's nervous condition and poor stamina. The coroner was suave and discreet. He spoke with bitter condemnation of people who write those despicable things, anonymous letters. Whoever had written that wicked and lying letter was morally guilty of murder, he said. He hoped the police would soon discover the culprit and take action against him or her. Such a dastardly and malicious piece of spite deserved to be punished with the utmost rigour of the law. Directed by him, the jury brought in the inevitable verdict. Suicide whilst temporarily insane. The coroner had done his best, Owen Griffith also, but afterwards, jammed in the crowd of eager village women, I heard the same hateful, sibilant whisper I had begun to know so well. No smoke without fire, that's what I say. Must have been something in it for certain, sure. She wouldn't never have done it otherwise. Just for a moment, I hated Limstock and its narrow boundaries, and its gossiping, whispering women. It is difficult to remember things in their exact chronological order. The next landmark of importance, of course, was Superintendent Nash's visit. But it was before that, I think, that we received calls from various members of the community, each of which was interesting in its way, and shed some light on the characters and personalities of the people involved. Amy Griffith came on the morning after the inquest. She was looking, as always, radiant with health and vigour, and succeeded, also as usual, in putting my back up almost immediately. Joanna and Megan were out, so I did the honours. "Good morning," said Miss Griffith. "I hear you've got Megan Hunter here."
"We have."
"Very good of you, I'm sure. Must be rather a nuisance to you. I came up to say she can come to us if you like. I dare say I can find ways of making her useful about the house."
I looked at Amy Griffith with a good deal of distaste. "How kind of you," I said. "But we like having her. She potters about quite happily."
"I dare say. Much too fond of pottering, that child. Still, I suppose she can't help it, being practically half-witted."
"I think she's rather an intelligent girl," I said. Amy Griffith gave me a hard stare.
"First time I've ever heard anyone say that of her," she remarked. "Why, when you talk to her, she looks through you as though she doesn't understand what you're saying."
"She probably just isn't interested," I said.
"If so, she's extremely rude," said Amy Griffith.
"That may be, but not half-witted." Miss Griffith declared sharply,
"At best it's wool-gathering. What Megan needs is good hard work, something to give her an interest in life. You've no idea what a difference that makes to a girl. I know a lot about girls. You'd be surprised at the difference even becoming a guide makes to a girl. Megan's much too old to spend her time lounging about and doing nothing."
"It's been rather difficult for her to do anything else so far," I said. "Mrs. Symington always seemed under the impression that Megan was about 12 years old.
Miss Griffith snorted. "I know. I had no patience with that attitude of hers. Of course, she's dead now, poor woman, so one doesn't want to say much, but she was a perfect example of what I call the unintelligent domestic type. Bridge and gossip and her children. And even there, that Holland girl did all the looking after them.
I'm afraid I never thought very much of Mrs. Symington, although, of course, I never suspected the truth.
The truth? I said sharply. Miss Griffith flushed. I was terribly sorry for Dick Symington. It's all having to come out as it did at the inquest, she said. It was awful for him. But surely you heard him say that there was not a word of truth in that letter, that he was quite sure of that.
Of course he said so. Quite right. The man's got to stick up for his wife. Dick would.
She paused and then explained.
You see, I've known Dick Symington a long time.
I was a little surprised.
Really? I said.
I understood from your brother that he only bought this practice a few years ago.
Oh, yes. But Dick Symington used to come and stay in our part of the world up north. I've known him for years.
Women jump to conclusions that men do not. Nevertheless, the suddenly softened tone of Amy Griffith's voice put, as our old nurse would have expressed it, ideas into my head. I looked at Amy curiously. She went on, still in that softened tone.
I know Dick very well. He's a proud man, and very reserved, but he's the sort of man who could be very jealous.
That would explain, I said deliberately, why Mrs. Symington was afraid to show him or tell him about the letter. She was afraid that, being a jealous man, he might not believe her denials. Miss Griffith looked at me angrily and scornfully.
Good Lord, she said. Do you think any woman would go and swallow a lot of cyanide of potassium for an accusation that wasn't true?
The coroner seemed to think it was possible. Your brother, too. Amy interrupted me. Men are all alike. All for preserving the decencies.
But you don't catch me believing that stuff. If an innocent woman gets some foul anonymous letter, she laughs and chucks it away. That's what I...
She paused suddenly and then finished.
Would do?
But I had noticed the pause. I was almost sure that what she had been about to say was, that's what I did. I decided to take the war into the enemy's country. I see, I said pleasantly. So you've had one too. Amy Griffith was the type of woman who scorns to lie. She paused a minute, flushed, then said,
Well, yes, but I didn't let it worry me.
Nasty? I inquired sympathetically, as a fellow sufferer.
Naturally. These things always are. The ravings of a lunatic. I read a few words of it, realised what it was, and chucked it straight into the waste paper basket.
You didn't think of taking it to the police?
Not then. Least said, soonest mended. That's what I felt. An urge came over me to say solemnly, No smoke without fire.
But I restrained myself. To avoid temptation, I reverted to Megan. Have you any idea of Megan's financial position? I asked. It's not idle curiosity on my part. I wondered if it would actually be necessary for her to earn her living.
I don't think it's strictly necessary. Her grandmother, her father's mother, left her a small income, I believe. And in any case, Dick Symington would always give her a home and provide for her, even if her mother hasn't left her anything outright. No, it's the principle of the thing.
What principle?
Work, Mr. Burton. There's nothing like work, for men and women. The one unforgivable sin is idleness.
Sir Edward Grey, I said, afterwards our foreign minister, was sent down from Oxford for incorrigible idleness. The Duke of Wellington, I have heard, was both dull and inattentive at his books. And has it ever occurred to you, Miss Griffith, that you would probably not be able to take a good express train to London if little Georgie Stevenson had been out with his youth movement instead of lolling about bored in his mother's kitchen until the curious behaviour of the kettle lid attracted the attention of his idle mind? Amy merely snorted.
It is a theory of mine, I said, warming to my theme, that we owe most of our great inventions and most of the achievements of genius to idleness, either enforced or voluntary. The human mind prefers to be spoon-fed with the thoughts of others. But, deprived of such nourishment, it will, reluctantly, begin to think for itself. And such thinking, remember, is original thinking, and may have valuable results.
Besides, I went on, before Amy could get in another sniff, there is the artistic side. I got up and took from my desk where it always accompanied me, a photograph of my favourite Chinese picture.
It represents an old man sitting beneath a tree, playing cat's cradle with a piece of string on his fingers and toes. It was in the Chinese exhibition, I said.
It fascinated me. Allow me to introduce you. It is called Old Man Enjoying the Pleasure of Idleness.
Amy Griffith was unimpressed by my lovely picture. She said, Oh, well, we all know what the Chinese are like. It doesn't appeal to you, I asked.
Frankly, no. I'm not very interested in art, I'm afraid.
Your attitude, Mr. Burton, is typical of that of most men. You dislike the idea of women working, of their competing.
I was taken aback. I had come up against the feminist. Amy was well away, her cheeks flushed.
It is incredible to you that women should want a career. It was incredible to my parents. I was anxious to study for a doctor. They would not hear of paying the fees, but they paid them readily for Owen. Yet I should have made a better doctor than my brother.
I'm sorry about that, I said. It was tough on you. If one wants to do a thing, she went on quickly.
Oh, I've got over it now. I've plenty of willpower. My life is busy and active. I'm one of the happiest people in Limstock. Plenty to do. But I do go up in arms against the silly old-fashioned prejudice that women's place is always the home.
I'm sorry if I offended you, I said, and that wasn't really my point. I don't see Megan in a domestic role at all.
No, poor child. She'll be a misfit anywhere, I'm afraid.
Amy had calmed down. She was speaking quite normally again.
Her father, you know.
She paused, and I said bluntly, I don't know. Everyone says her father and drops their voice, and that is that.
What did the man do?
Is he alive still?
I really don't know. And I'm rather vague myself, I'm afraid. But he was definitely a bad lot. Prison, I believe, and a streak of very strong abnormality. That's why it wouldn't surprise me if Megan was a bit wanting.
Megan, I said, is in full possession of her senses, and as I said before, I consider her an intelligent girl. My sister thinks so too. Joanna is very fond of her. Amy said,
I'm afraid your sister must find it very dull down here.
And as she said it, I learned something else. Amy Griffith disliked my sister. It was there in the smooth, conventional tones of her voice.
We've all wondered how you could both bear to bury yourselves in such an out-of-the-way spot.
It was a question, and I answered it. Doctor's orders.
I was to come somewhere very quiet where nothing ever happened.
I paused and added, Not quite true of Limstock now.
No, no indeed.
She sounded worried and got up to go. She said then, You know, it's got to be put a stop to all this beastliness. We can't have it going on.
Aren't the police doing anything?
I suppose so. But I think we ought to take it in hand ourselves.
We're not as well equipped as they are.
Nonsense. We probably have far more sense and intelligence. A little determination is all that is needed.
She said goodbye abruptly and went away. When Joanna and Megan came back from their walk, I showed Megan my Chinese picture. Her face lighted up. She said,
It's heavenly, isn't it?
It is, rather, my opinion.
Her forehead was crinkling in the way I knew so well.
But it would be difficult, wouldn't it?
To be idle?
No,
not to be idle, but to enjoy the pleasures of it. You'd have to be very old. She paused. I said, He is an old man.
I don't mean old that way. Not age. I mean old in...
You mean, I said, that one would have to attain a very high state of civilization for the thing to present itself to you in that way, a fine point of sophistication. I think I should complete your education, Megan, by reading to you 100 poems translated from the Chinese. I met Symington in the town later in the day.
Is it quite all right for Megan to stay on with us for a bit? I asked.
It's company for Joanna. She's rather lonely sometimes with none of her own friends.
Megan? Oh, yes, very good of you.
I took a dislike to Symington then, which I never quite overcame. He had so obviously forgotten all about Megan. I wouldn't have minded if he had actively disliked the girl. A man may sometimes be jealous of a first husband's child. But he didn't dislike her. He just hardly noticed her. He felt towards her much as a man who doesn't care much for dogs would feel about a dog in the house. You notice it when you fall over it and swear at it, and you give it a vague pat sometimes when it presents itself to be patted. Symington's complete indifference to his stepdaughter annoyed me very much. I said, "What are you planning to do with her?" "With Megan?" He seemed rather startled.
"Well, she'll go on living at home. I mean, naturally, it is her home."
My grandmother, of whom I'd been very fond, used to sing old-fashioned songs to her guitar. One of them, I remembered, ended thus. "O maid most dear, I am not here. I have no place, no part. No dwelling more, by sea nor shore, but only in your heart." I went home humming it. Emily Barton came just after tea had been cleared away. She wanted to talk about the garden. We talked garden for about half an hour. Then we turned back towards the house. It was then that, lowering her voice, she murmured,
"I do hope that child, that she hasn't been too much upset by all this dreadful business."
"Her mother's death, you mean?"
"That, of course. But I really meant the unpleasantness behind it."
I was curious. I wanted Miss Barton's reaction. "What do you think about that? Was it true?"
"Oh, no, no, surely not. I'm quite sure that Mrs. Symington never, that he wasn't..."
Little Emily Barton was pink and confused. "I mean, it's quite untrue. Although, of course, it may have been a judgment." "A judgment?" I said, staring. Emily Barton was very pink, very Dresden China shepherdess-like.
"I cannot help feeling that all these dreadful letters, all the sorrow and pain they have caused, may have been sent for a purpose."
"They were sent for a purpose, certainly," I said grimly.
"No, no, Mr. Burton, you misunderstood me. I'm not talking of the misguided creature who wrote them. Someone quite abandoned, that must be. I mean that they have been permitted by Providence to awaken us to a sense of our shortcomings."
"Surely," I said, "the Almighty could choose a less unsavoury weapon." Miss Emily murmured that God moved in a mysterious way. "No," I said, "there's too much tendency to attribute to God the evils that man does of his own free will. I might concede you the devil. God doesn't really need to punish us, Miss Barton. We're so very busy punishing ourselves."
"What I can't make out is, why should anyone want to do such a thing?"
I shrugged my shoulders. "A warped mentality?"
"It seems very sad."
"It doesn't seem to me sad. It seems to me just damnable. And I don't apologise for the word. I mean just that." The pink had gone out of Miss Barton's cheeks. They were very white.
"But why, Mr. Burton, why? What pleasure can anyone get out of it?"
"Nothing you and I can understand, thank goodness." Emily Barton lowered her voice.
"They say that Mrs. Cleet, but I really cannot believe it."
I shook my head. She went on in an agitated manner.
"Nothing of this kind has ever happened before, never in my memory. It has been such a happy little community. What would my dear mother have said? Well, one must be thankful that she has been spared."
I thought from all I had heard that old Mrs. Barton had been sufficiently tough to have taken anything, and would probably have enjoyed this sensation. Emily went on.
"It distresses me deeply."
"You've not, had anything yourself?" She flushed crimson.
"Oh, no. Oh, no, indeed. Oh, that would be dreadful."
I apologised hastily, but she went away looking rather upset. I went into the house. Joanna was standing by the drawing-room fire, which she had just lit, for the evenings were still chilly. She had an open letter in her hand. She turned her head quickly as I entered. "Jerry, I found this in the letterbox, dropped in by hand. It begins, 'You painted Trollope.'
What else does it say? Joanna gave a wide grimace. Same old muck. She dropped it onto the fire. With a quick gesture that hurt my back, I jerked it off again just before it caught. Don't, I said. We may need it.
Need it?
For the police. Superintendent Nash came to see me the following morning. From the first moment I saw him, I took a great liking to him. He was the best type of CID county superintendent. Tall, soldierly, with quiet, reflective eyes and a straightforward, unassuming manner. He said, "Good morning, Mr. Burton. I expect you can guess what I've come to see you about." "Yes, I think so." "This letter business," he nodded. "I understand you had one of them." "Yes, soon after we got here." "What did it say exactly?" I thought a minute, then conscientiously repeated the wording of the letter as closely as possible. The superintendent listened with an immovable face, showing no signs of any kind of emotion. When I had finished, he said, "I see. You didn't keep the letter, Mr. Burton." "I'm sorry I didn't. You see, I thought it was just an isolated instance of spite against newcomers to the place." The superintendent inclined his head comprehendingly. He said briefly, "A pity." "However," I said, "my sister got one yesterday. I just stopped her putting it in the fire." "Thank you, Mr. Burton. That was thoughtful of you." I went across to my desk and unlocked the drawer in which I had put it. It was not, I thought, really suitable for Partridge's eyes. I gave it to Nash. He read it through. Then he looked up and asked me, "Is this the same in appearance as the last one?" "I think so, as far as I can remember." "The same difference between the envelope and the text?" "Yes," I said. "The envelope was typed. The letter itself had printed words pasted onto a sheet of paper." Nash nodded and put it in his pocket. Then he said, "I wonder, Mr. Burton, if you would mind coming down to the station with me. We could have a conference there, and it would save a good deal of time and overlapping." "Certainly," I said. "You would like me to come now, if you don't mind?" There was a police car at the door. We drove down in it. I said, "Do you think you'll be able to get to the bottom of this?" Nash nodded with easy confidence. "Oh, yes. We'll get to the bottom of it, all right. It's a question of time and routine. They're slow, these cases, but they're pretty sure. It's a matter of narrowing things down." "Elimination?" I said. "Yes. And general routine. Watching postboxes, examining typewriters, fingerprints, all that." He smiled. "As you say." At the police station, I found Symington and Griffith were already there. I was introduced to a tall, lantern-jawed man in plain clothes, Inspector Graves.
"Inspector Graves," explained Nash, "has come down from London to help us. He's an expert on anonymous letter cases."
Inspector Graves smiled mournfully. I reflected that a life spent in the pursuit of anonymous letter writers must be singularly depressing. Inspector Graves, however, showed a kind of melancholy enthusiasm.
"They're all the same, these cases," he said in a deep, lugubrious voice like a depressed bloodhound. "You'd be surprised. The wording of the letters and the things they say."
"We had a case just on 2 years ago," said Nash. "Inspector Graves helped us then."
Some of the letters I saw were spread out on the table in front of Graves. He had evidently been examining them.
"Difficulty is," said Nash, "to get hold of the letters. Either people put them in the fire, or they won't admit to having received anything of the kind. Stupid, you see, and afraid of being mixed up with the police. They're a backward lot here."
"Still, we've got a fair amount to get on with," said Graves.
Nash took the letter I had given him from his pocket and tossed it over to Graves. The latter glanced through it, laid it with the others, and observed approvingly,
"Very nice. Very nice indeed."
It was not the way I should have chosen to describe the epistle in question, but experts, I suppose, have their own point of view. I was glad that that screed of vituperative and obscene abuse gave somebody pleasure.
"We've got enough, I think, to go on with," said Inspector Graves, "and I'll ask you, gentlemen, if you should get any more, to bring them along at once. Also, if you hear of someone else getting one, you in particular, Doctor, among your patients, do your best to get them to come along here with them. I've got," he sorted with deft fingers among his exhibits, "one to Mr. Symington, received as far back as 2 months ago, one to Dr. Griffith,
one to Miss Ginch, one written to Mrs. Mudge, the butcher's wife, one to Jennifer Clark, barmaid at the Three Crowns, the one received by Mrs. Symington, this one now to Miss Burton, oh yes, and one from the bank manager.
Quite a representative collection, I remarked.
And not one I couldn't match from other cases. This one here is as near as nothing to one written by that milliner woman. This one is the dead spit of an outbreak we had up in Northumberland, written by a schoolgirl, they were. I can tell you, gentlemen, I'd like to see something new sometimes, instead of the same old treadmill.
There is nothing new under the sun, I murmured.
Quite so, sir. You'd know that if you were in our profession.
Nash sighed and said, Yes, indeed. Symington asked, Have you come to any definite opinion as to the writer? Graves cleared his throat and delivered a small lecture.
There are certain similarities shared by all these letters. I shall enumerate them, gentlemen, in case they suggest anything to your minds. The text of the letters is composed of words made up from individual letters cut out of a printed book. It's an old book, printed, I should say, about the year 1830. This has obviously been done to avoid the risk of recognition through handwriting, which is, as most people know nowadays, a fairly easy matter, the so-called disguising of a hand not amounting to much when faced with expert tests. There are no fingerprints on the letters and envelopes of a distinctive character. That is to say, they have been handled by the postal authorities, the recipient, and there are other stray fingerprints, but no set common to all, showing, therefore, that the person who put them together was careful to wear gloves. The envelopes are typewritten by a Windsor 7 machine, well-worn, with the A and the T out of alignment. Most of them have been posted locally or put in the box of a house by hand. It is therefore evident that they are of local provenance. They were written by a woman, and in my opinion a woman of middle age or over, and probably, though not certainly, unmarried. We maintained a respectful silence for a minute or two. Then I said, The typewriter's your best bet, isn't it? That oughtn't to be difficult in a little place like this. Inspector Graves shook his head sadly and said, That's where you're wrong, sir.
The typewriter, said Superintendent Nash, is unfortunately too easy. It is an old one from Mr. Symington's office, given by him to the Women's Institute, where, I may say, it's very easy of access. The ladies here all often go into the Institute. Can't you tell something definite from the, touch, don't you call it?
Again, Graves nodded. Yes, that can be done. But these envelopes have all been typed by someone using one finger.
Someone, then, unused to the typewriter?
No, I wouldn't say that. Someone, say, who can type, but doesn't want us to know the fact.
Whoever writes these things has been very cunning, I said slowly.
She is, sir, she is, said Graves, up to every trick of the trade.
I shouldn't have thought one of these bucolic women down here would have had the brains, I said. Graves coughed.
I haven't made myself plain, I'm afraid. Those letters were written by an educated woman.
What, by a lady? The word slipped out involuntarily. I hadn't used the term lady for years, but now it came automatically to my lips, re-echoed from days long ago, and my grandmother's faint, unconsciously arrogant voice saying, Of course, she isn't a lady, dear. Nash understood at once. The word lady still meant something to him.
Not necessarily a lady, he said, but certainly not a village woman. They're mostly pretty illiterate down here, can't spell, and certainly can't express themselves with fluency.
I was silent, for I had had a shock. The community was so small. Unconsciously, I had visualized the writer of the letters as a Mrs. Cleet or her like, some spiteful, cunning half-wit. Symington put my thoughts into words. He said sharply,
But that narrows it down to about half a dozen to a dozen people in the whole place.
That's right. I can't believe it.
Then, with a slight effort, and looking straight in front of him, as though the mere sound of his own words were distasteful, he said,
You have heard what I stated at the inquest. In case you may have thought that that statement was actuated by a desire to protect my wife's memory, I should like to repeat now that I am firmly convinced
the subject matter of the letter my wife received was absolutely false. I know it was false. My wife was a very sensitive woman, and, well, you might call it prudish in some respects. Such a letter would have been a great shock to her, and she was in poor health. Graves responded instantly. That's quite likely to be right, sir. None of these letters show any signs of intimate knowledge. They're just blind accusations. There's been no attempt to blackmail, and there doesn't seem to be any religious bias, such as we sometimes get. It's just sex and spite, and that's going to give us quite a good pointer towards the writer.
Symington got up. Dry and unemotional as the man was, his lips were trembling.
I hope you find the devil who writes these soon. She murdered my wife as surely as if she'd put a knife into her.
He paused.
How does she feel now, I wonder?
He went out, leaving that question unanswered. How does she feel, Griffith? I asked. It seemed to me the answer was in his province.
God knows. Remorseful, perhaps. On the other hand, it may be that she's enjoying her power. Mrs. Symington's death may have fed her mania. I hope not, I said with a slight shiver, because if so, she'll...
I hesitated, and Nash finished the sentence for me.
She'll try it again? That, Mr. Burton, would be the best thing that could happen for us. The pitcher goes to the well once too often, remember. She'd be mad to go on with it, I exclaimed. She'll go on, said Graves. They always do. It's a vice, you know. They can't let it alone. I shook my head with a shudder. I asked if they needed me any longer. I wanted to get out into the air.
The atmosphere seemed tinged with evil.
There's nothing more, Mr. Burton, said Nash. Only keep your eyes open and do as much propaganda as you can. That is to say, urge on everyone that they've got to report any letter they receive. I nodded.
I should think everyone in the place has had one of the foul things by now, I said.
I wonder, said Graves.
He put his sad head a little on one side and asked,
You don't know definitely of anyone who hasn't had a letter? What an extraordinary question. The population at large isn't likely to take me into their confidence. No, no, Mr. Burton, I didn't mean that. I just wondered if you knew of any one person who quite definitely, to your certain knowledge, has not received an anonymous letter.
Well, as a matter of fact, I hesitated. I do, in a way. And I repeated my conversation with Emily Barton, and what she had said. Graves received the information with a wooden face and said,
Well, that may come in useful. I'll note it down.
I went out into the afternoon sunshine with Owen Griffith. Once in the street, I swore aloud.
What kind of place is this for a man to come to lie in the sun and heal his wounds? It's full of festering poison, this place, and it looks as peaceful and as innocent as the Garden of Eden.
Even there, said Owen dryly, there was one serpent. Look here, Griffith. Do they know anything? Have they got any idea?
I don't know. They've got a wonderful technique, the police. They're seemingly so frank and they tell you nothing.
Yes.
Nash is a nice fellow.
And a very capable one.
If anyone's batty in this place, you ought to know it, I said accusingly.
Griffith shook his head. He looked discouraged. But he looked more than that. He looked worried.
I wondered if he had an inkling of some kind.
We had been walking along the high street. I stopped at the door of the house agents.
I believe my second installment of rent is due, in advance. I've got a good mind to pay it and clear out with Joanna right away.
Forfeit the rest of the tenancy.
Don't go, said Owen.
Why not? He didn't answer. He said slowly, after a minute or two,
After all, I dare say you're right. Limstock isn't healthy just now. It might harm you or your sister.
Nothing harms Joanna, I said. She's tough. I'm the weakly one. Somehow this business makes me sick.
It makes me sick, said Owen.
I pushed the door of the house agents half open.
But I shan't go, I said. Vulgar curiosity is stronger than pusillanimity. I want to know the solution.
I went in. A woman who was typing got up and came towards me.
She had frizzy hair and simpered, but I found her more intelligent than the spectacled youth who had previously held sway in the outer office. A minute or two later, something familiar about her penetrated through to my consciousness. It was Miss Ginch, lately Symington's lady clerk. I commented on the fact. "You were with Galbraith and Symington, weren't you?" I said. "Yes, yes indeed. But I thought it was better to leave. This is quite a good post, though not quite so well paid. But there are things that are more valuable than money, don't you think so?" "Undoubtedly," I said.
"Those awful letters," breathed Miss Ginch in a sibilant whisper. "I've got a dreadful one about me and Mr. Symington. Oh, terrible it was, saying the most awful things. I knew my duty, and I took it to the police, though of course it wasn't exactly pleasant for me, was it?"
"No, no, most unpleasant."
"But they thanked me and said I had done quite right. But I felt that after that, if people were talking, and evidently they must have been, or where did the writer get the idea from, then I must avoid even the appearance of evil, though there has never been anything at all wrong between me and Mr. Symington."
I felt rather embarrassed. "No, no, of course not.
But people have such evil minds. Yes, alas, such evil minds."
Nervously trying to avoid it, I nevertheless met her eye and made a most unpleasant discovery. Miss Ginch was thoroughly enjoying herself. Already once today I had come across someone who reacted pleasurably to anonymous letters. Inspector Graves's enthusiasm was professional. Miss Ginch's enjoyment I found merely suggestive and disgusting. An idea flashed across my startled mind. Had Miss Ginch written these letters herself? Chapter 7. When I got home, I found Mrs. Dane Calthrop sitting talking to Joanna. She looked, I thought, grey and ill. "This has been a terrible shock to me, Mr. Burton," she said. "Poor thing, poor thing." "Yes," I said. "It's awful to think of someone being driven to the stage of taking their own life." "Oh, you mean Mrs. Symington?" "Didn't you?" Mrs. Dane Calthrop shook her head. "Of course, one is sorry for her. But it would have been bound to happen anyway, wouldn't it?"
"Would it?" said Joanna dryly.
Mrs. Dane Calthrop turned to her. "Oh, I think so, dear. If suicide is your idea of escape from trouble, then it doesn't very much matter what the trouble is. Whenever some very unpleasant shock had to be faced, she'd have done the same thing. What it really comes down to is that she was that kind of woman. Not that one would have guessed it. She always seemed to me a selfish, rather stupid woman with a good, firm hold on life. Not the kind to panic, you would think. But I'm beginning to realise how little I really know anyone." "I'm still curious as to whom you meant when you said poor thing," I remarked. She stared at me. "The woman who wrote the letters, of course." "I don't think," I said dryly, "I shall waste sympathy on her." Mrs. Dane Calthrop leaned forward. She laid a hand on my knee. "But don't you realise? Can't you feel? Use your imagination. Think how desperately, violently unhappy anyone must be to sit down and write these things. How lonely, how cut off from humankind. Poisoned through and through with a dark stream of poison that finds its outlet in this way. That's why I feel so self-reproachful. Somebody in this town has been racked with that terrible unhappiness, and I've had no idea of it. I should have had. You can't interfere with actions. I never do. But that black inward unhappiness, like a septic arm physically, all black and swollen. If you could cut it and let the poison out, it would flow away harmlessly. Yes. Poor soul, poor soul." She got up to go. I did not feel like agreeing with her. I had no sympathy for our anonymous letter-writer whatsoever. But I did ask, curiously, "Have you any idea at all, Mrs. Calthrop, who this woman is?" She turned her fine, perplexed eyes on me. "Well, I can guess," she said. "But then I might be wrong, mightn't I?" She went swiftly out through the door, popping her head back to ask, "Do tell me, why have you never married, Mr. Burton?" In anyone else, it would have been an impertinence, But with Mrs. Dane Calthrop, you felt that the idea had suddenly come into her head, and she had really wanted to know.
"Shall we say," I said, rallying, "that I have never met the right woman?" "We can say so," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop, "but it wouldn't be a very good answer, because so many men have obviously married the wrong woman."
This time she really departed.
Joanna said, "You know, I really do think she's mad. But I like her. The people in the village here are afraid of her."
"So am I, a little."
"Because you never know what's coming next."
"Yes.
And there's a careless brilliancy about her guesses."
Joanna said slowly, "Do you really think whoever wrote these letters is very unhappy?"
"I don't know what the damned hag is thinking or feeling, and I don't care. It's her victims I'm sorry for."
It seems odd to me now that in our speculations about Poison Pen's frame of mind, we missed the most obvious one. Griffith had pictured her as possibly exultant. I had envisaged her as remorseful, appalled by the result of her handiwork. Mrs. Dane Calthrop had seen her as suffering. Yet the obvious, the inevitable reaction we did not consider, or perhaps I should say I did not consider. That reaction was fear. For, with the death of Mrs. Symington, the letters had passed out of one category into another. I don't know what the legal position was. Symington knew, I suppose, but it was clear that with a death resulting, the position of the writer of the letters was much more serious. There could now be no question of passing it off as a joke if the identity of the writer was discovered. The police were active. A Scotland Yard expert called in. It was vital now for the anonymous author to remain anonymous. And, granted that fear was the principal reaction, other things followed. Those possibilities also I was blind to. Yet, surely they should have been obvious. Joanna and I came down rather late to breakfast the next morning. That is to say, late by the standards of Limstock. It was 9:30, an hour at which in London Joanna was just unclosing an eyelid, and mine would probably be still tight shut. However, when Partridge had said, "Breakfast at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, neither Joanna nor I had had the nerve to suggest a later hour. To my annoyance, Amy Griffith was standing on the doorstep talking to Megan. She gave tongue with her usual heartiness at the sight of us. "Hello there, slackers. I've been up for hours." That, of course, was her own business. A doctor no doubt has to have early breakfast, and a dutiful sister is there to pour out his tea or coffee. But it is no excuse for coming and butting in on one's more somnolent neighbours. 9:30 is not the time for a morning call. Megan slipped back into the house and into the dining room, where I gathered she had been interrupted in her breakfast. "I said I wouldn't come in," said Amy Griffith. Though why it is more of a merit to force people to come and speak to you on the doorstep than to talk to them inside the house, I do not know. "I just wanted to ask Miss Burton if she'd any vegetables to spare for our Red Cross stall on the main road. If so, I'd get Owen to call for them in the car." "You're out and about very early," I said. "The early bird catches the worm," said Amy. "You have a better chance of finding people in this time of day. I'm off to Mr. Pye's next. Got to go over to Brenton this afternoon. Guides." "Your energy makes me quite tired," I said. And at that moment the telephone rang and I retired to the back of the hall to answer it, leaving Joanna murmuring rather doubtfully something about rhubarb and French beans and exposing her ignorance of the vegetable garden. "Yes," I said into the telephone mouthpiece. A confused noise of deep breathing came from the other end of the wire, and a doubtful female voice said,
"Oh."
"Yes," I said again, encouragingly.
"Oh,"
said the voice again, and then it inquired adenoidally,
"Is that... what I mean, is that Little Furs?"
"This is Little Furs."
"Oh."
This was clearly a stock beginning to every sentence. The voice inquired cautiously,
"Could I speak to Miss Partridge just a minute?"
"Certainly," I said. "Who shall I say?"
"Oh, tell her it's Agnes, would you? Agnes Waddle."
"Agnes Waddle."
"That's right."
Resisting the temptation to say Donald Duck to you, I put down the telephone receiver and called up the stairs to where I could hear the sound of Partridge's activities overhead. "Partridge, Partridge!" Partridge appeared at the head of the stairs, a long mop in one hand and a look of "what is it now?" clearly discernible behind her invariably respectful manner. "Yes, sir? Agnes Waddle wants to speak to you on the telephone." "I beg your pardon, sir?" I raised my voice. "Agnes Waddle." "Agnes Waddell! Whatever can she want now?" Very much put out of countenance, Partridge relinquished her mop and rustled down the stairs, her print dress crackling with agitation. I beat an unobtrusive retreat into the dining room where Megan was wolfing down kidneys and bacon. Megan, unlike Amy Griffith, was displaying no glorious morning face. In fact, she replied very gruffly to my morning salutations and continued to eat in silence. I opened the morning paper, and a minute or two later Joanna entered, looking somewhat shattered. "Phew," she said. "I'm so tired. And I think I've exposed my utter ignorance of what grows when. Aren't there runner beans this time of year?"
"August," said Megan.
"Well, one has them any time in London," said Joanna defensively.
"Tins, sweet fool," I said, "and cold storage on ships from the far-flung limits of empire."
"Like ivory, apes and peacocks?" asked Joanna.
"Exactly."
"I'd rather have peacocks," said Joanna thoughtfully.
"I'd like a monkey of my own as a pet," said Megan. Meditatively peeling an orange, Joanna said, "I wonder what it would feel like to be Amy Griffith,
all bursting with health and vigour and enjoyment of life. Do you think she's ever tired or depressed or wistful?"
I said I was quite certain Amy Griffith was never wistful, and followed Megan out of the open French window onto the veranda. Standing there, filling my pipe, I heard Partridge enter the dining room from the hall, and heard her voice say grimly, "Can I speak to you a minute, miss?"
Dear me, I thought, I hope Partridge isn't going to give notice. Emily Barton will be very annoyed with us if so.
Partridge went on,
"I must apologise, miss, for being rung up on the telephone. That is to say, the young person who did so should have known better. I have never been in the habit of using the telephone or of permitting my friends to ring me up on it, and I'm very sorry indeed that it should have occurred, and the master taking the call and everything."
"Why, that's quite all right, Partridge," said Joanna soothingly.
"Why shouldn't your friends use the phone if they want to speak to you?"
Partridge's face, I could feel, though I could not see it, was more dour than ever as she replied coldly,
"It is not the kind of thing that has ever been done in this house. Miss Emily would never permit it. As I say, I am sorry it occurred, but Agnes Waddell, the girl who did it, was upset, and she's young, too, and doesn't know what's fitting in a gentleman's house."
"That's one for you, Joanna," I thought gleefully.
"This Agnes who rung me up, miss," went on Partridge, "she used to be in service here under me. 16 she was then, and come straight from the orphanage. And, you see, not having a home or a mother or any relations to advise her, she's been in the habit of coming to me. I can tell her what's what, you see."
"Yes," said Joanna, and waited. Clearly there was more to follow.
"So, I'm taking the liberty of asking you, miss, if you would allow Agnes to come here to tea this afternoon in the kitchen. It's her day out, you see, and she's got something on her mind she wants to consult me about. I wouldn't dream of suggesting such a thing in the usual way."
Joanna said, bewildered, "But why shouldn't you have anyone to tea with you?" Partridge drew herself up at this, so Joanna said afterwards, and really looked most formidable, as she replied,
"It has never been the custom of this house, miss. Old Mrs. Barton never allowed visitors in the kitchen, excepting as it should be our own day out, in which case we were allowed to entertain friends here instead of going out, but otherwise, on ordinary days, no. And Miss Emily, she keeps to the old ways."
"Joanna is very nice to servants, and most of them like her, but she has never cut any ice with Partridge." "It's no good, my girl," I said when Partridge had gone and Joanna had joined me outside. "Your sympathy and leniency are not appreciated.
The good old overbearing ways for Partridge, and things done the way they should be done in a gentleman's house."
"I never heard of such tyranny as not allowing them to have their friends to see them," said Joanna.
"It's all very well, Jerry, but they can't like being treated like black slaves."
"Evidently they do," I said. "At least, the Partridges of this world do."
"I can't imagine why she doesn't like me.
Most people do.
She probably despises you as an inadequate housekeeper. You never draw your hand across a shelf and examine it for traces of dust. You don't look under the mats. You don't ask what happened to the remains of the chocolate souffle. And you never order a nice bread pudding.
Ugh,
said Joanna. She went on sadly. I'm a failure all round today. Despised by our Amy for ignorance of the vegetable kingdom. Snubbed by Partridge for being a human being. I shall now go out into the garden and eat worms. Megan's there already, I said. For Megan had wandered away a few minutes previously, and was now standing aimlessly in the middle of a patch of lawn, looking not unlike a meditative bird waiting for nourishment. She came back, however, towards us, and said abruptly, I say, I must go home today. What? I was dismayed. She went on, flushing, but speaking with nervous determination. It's been awfully good of you having me, and I expect I've been a fearful nuisance, but I have enjoyed it awfully. Only now I must go back, because, after all, well, it's my home, and one can't stay away forever, so I think I'll go this morning. Both Joanna and I tried to make her change her mind, but she was quite adamant, and finally Joanna got out the car, and Megan went upstairs and came down a few minutes later with her belongings packed up again. The only person pleased seemed to be Partridge, who had almost a smile on her grim face. She had never liked Megan much.
End of disc 3.